from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny in a special broadcast from the California Academy of Sciences this morning. If you think mind control is the stuff of movies, think again. There's a fungus that takes over an ant's brain, turning it into a zombie. There's also a fish that chokes its enemies with slimy snot, and a frog that uses its mustache for fighting. These are just some of the unique ways animals have adapted to survive. We'll talk to Wired writer Matt Simon, an Academy scientist, about the wild and weird creatures they study, all coming up on Forum after this news. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny, and we are in the California Academy of Sciences with a live broadcast and a live studio audience. Thank you for that. This hour, well, evolution, I think many of you know, has created a number of unique animals. You think about hammerhead sharks or pygmy seahorses, but the ones we're going to talk about this hour may come as a surprise even to the amateur zoologists who are out amongst us. There's a toad, for example, that grows a mustache made of spikes along its upper lip. There's a sea slug that absorbs the powerful qualities of the animals that it eats. And there's a fish the size of a pickup truck that floats through the water like a giant Hindenburg blimp. We have assembled a panel here, and let me introduce them to you. Matt Simon is familiar with many of these animals. He's a science writer for Wired, and he used to write a column called Absurd Creature of the Week. He also has a new book out called The Wasp That Brainwashed the Caterpillar, Evolution's Unbelievable Solutions to Life's Biggest Problems. Welcome, Matt Simon.
And thank you for having me.
Glad to have you. Also glad to have Brian Fisher, who is curator and chair of entomology here at the Cal Academy of Sciences. And for over 20 years, he's traveled the globe identifying and naming ants. And he's discovered on his own 1,000 ant species of the 22,000 that exist, many more to be discovered. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. Tierney Tease is also with us. She's a marine biologist. She studies the sunfish, also known as the mola. She's also a filmmaker and National Geographic explorer based in Monterey. We welcome you. Good morning.
Happy to be here.
Happy to have you. And Rebecca Johnson, who I mentioned in the last hour, citizen science research coordinator here at the Cal Academy, who studies the nudibranch, a type of sea slug. She and her colleague Allison Young recently won the 2017 Bay Nature Local Hero Award for environmental education. Congratulations, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Michael.
This is a terrific panel, and I'm anxious to find out about what they have to tell us about all these unusual creatures. Let me begin with Matt Simon. When we were promoting the show, we were talking about the hipster toad. That's the toad that uses this weaponized mustache, this species on its upper lip. I mean, this is pretty unusual, to put it mildly, and something that little people know about. So tell us about the hipster toad. Tell us about it first from the standpoint of its mating. Then we'll get to the mustache. Because it goes on a rock to mate, as I understand it, and actually cares for the eggs, not only its own eggs, but eggs of fellow people that were combatants with it before.
Yeah, I mean, we should also say this is also known as the Tom Selleck toad, appropriately. This is interesting in that it is the male that takes care of the eggs, and when they mate, they actually do so underwater, in these little caves of sorts. To mate, though, they need to win that right, and this is where the mustache comes in. So every breeding season, the males will grow 6 or 7 of these very sharp spines along their upper lip. These are made of keratin, the same material as your fingernails, and these are so sharp that they will wound pretty much everything that comes into their way.
Like a porcupine.
It is indeed. So what happens is males come together almost like sumo wrestlers. They'll grasp each other with these very strong arms and jab at each other with these mustaches, and they can puncture skin and sometimes organs and things like that.
You don't see that in singles bars, is that right?
No, luckily, no. So whoever wins that fight wins that cave, and the right to mate with the female, who'll come along and tell the male, I like your cave, let's mate. They do so, and he uses his legs to actually stick the eggs at the top of the cave where they'll sit, and he'll take care of them until they hatch and swim away.
The female is gone.
She's gone. She took off. She has no use for him anymore, and it's all his problem now.
Just the sperm donors. You've got all these creatures that you write about, Matt, and many of them have these evolutionary ways of survival, which are fascinating. For example, there's a fish, let me just have you talk about this for a moment, that finds its home in the butt of a sea cucumber, right?
Yeah. This is a popular one. This is called the pearlfish. It looks not unlike an eel, but it is a fish, and what it does is it seeks out shelter in the seafloor, not in coral. Decidedly not in coral. She'll find a sea cucumber, and a sea cucumber has an anus like a lot of creatures, but it breathes out of that anus as well. So what you'll find is that these pearlfish will be sneaking around trying to find these sea cucumbers, and when a sea cucumber detects this, it will actually close up its anus to keep the pearlfish out. But when it does that, it is essentially holding its breath. So it eventually has to breathe, and when it does so, the pearlfish swims up there into the sea cucumber. And it is not behaving, by the way, when it's up there. It is eating organs, such as the gonads of the sea cucumber, which is fine, don't worry. The sea cucumber can remarkably regenerate all these organs. So what it does is it gets up there. Sometimes two will get up there, and they're not going to behave in that sense either. They will mate in the sea cucumber, which is an extra indignity considering it has essentially sterilized the sea cucumber that is making a home. Strange solutions on the seafloor.
Yeah, I'm not even going to go near a regeneration of gonads.
Yeah.
Let's. we've been promoting, as I said, some of these creatures, and the one that I suppose maybe piqued the most curiosity was the zombie ant.
My favorite. I'm going to blow your mind, Michael. Are you ready for this? If you lose consciousness, this is not my fault. So there's a zombie ant in the Amazon rainforest. It's a fungus, actually, that infects it. The fungus spore falls out of a tree and lands on the cuticle of an ant, it's sort of like its skin, and uses pressure to blow itself through the cuticle and into the inside of the ant. When it does that, it begins replicating, growing through the tissues, working its way toward the brain, where it starts releasing chemicals that change the behavior of the ant in extremely specific ways. It will drive the ant at a specific time of day, at about noon, up about 10 inches off the ground, and bite down always on the vein of a leaf, always pointing northwest, almost always. The consistency is astounding considering it's a fungus that doesn't have a brain of its own and is instead manipulating the brain of the ant. What happens when it bites onto the leaf? It kills the ant and erupts out of the back of its head as a stalk and rains down spores onto the colony below. It has perfectly positioned itself above the trails to infect the most ants. And what's the incredible research that's coming out now is that they're finding that this fungus is not just growing around the brain, but through the muscles of the ant, and actually severing the neurons, which doesn't make any sense because it needs to be driving this ant up into the canopy. So what a scientist who's working on this is theorizing that it is actually functionally replacing the nervous system in the ant's body. So it is growing through those muscles, breaking them, and then somehow releasing neurotransmitters that keeps them working, which is as close as you can get to a functional puppet master in the animal kingdom.
You're hearing Matt Simon, science writer and video host for Wired, also used to write Wired's Absurd Creature of the Week column, and he has a new book out called The Wasp That Brainwashed the Caterpillar. I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about that. Wasp that brainwashed the caterpillar?
Yes. Glyptopontales is what it's called. Wasps are mean. You might have known from your childhood. They sting, but they get much meaner than that, and it's generally toward smaller creatures. So in the book, we have the creature Glyptopontales. The female wasp will sting a caterpillar and inject her eggs, sometimes about 80 of them at a time. Those eggs, again, not behaving inside the creature that they call home. They are consuming its fluids and growing bigger and bigger. At a certain point, they all decide to erupt en masse out of the caterpillar through its skin by drilling out pretty much every square inch of the caterpillar's skin. What's curious is that this does not kill the caterpillar. And what seems to be happening is as they are coming out of the caterpillar, they're doing their last shed of their exoskeleton. And that might be plugging up the wound to keep the caterpillar alive, because what they want to do with a caterpillar is turn it into a bodyguard. So as they spin their cocoons on this leaf, what the caterpillar will do is not eat them, which you would expect for something that's been assaulted like this, it will actually spin its own silk over the eggs to protect them even further. And if you get parasitoid wasps that are trying to parasitize the parasites, the caterpillar will actually bat its head and knock them away. And it has an amazing success rate. It's something like 60% batting these other predators away to keep these parasites safe when, again, these things have done it poorly. I wouldn't want to protect things like this that have come out of my body like that. But this is how it's happening in nature. It's zombification is extremely common in the animal kingdom. It has evolved many, many times across the tree of life, and it is absolutely fascinating.
Well, it's absolutely fascinating what each of these panelists, including Matt Simon, have brought to our attention. And I want to talk next to Tierney Tease, who is a marine biologist, filmmaker, and National Geographic explorer, studies the giant sunfish, which can grow, by the way, more than 10 feet long and weigh over 5,000 pounds, feeds mainly on jellyfish. And I think in your TED Talk you said this is not necessarily the greatest form of sushi, but it does feed itself constantly on jellyfish. Yeah.
I mean, that's actually can be a great prey item to capitalize on, especially in some places where we've pulled out a lot of the food fish and the jellies have taken up residence. We need our jelly eaters intact. Leatherback turtles, molas, all of them.
Well, these are molas, in fact. When we talk about sunfish, that's the actual name that they're known as. But let's talk about their evolution a little bit, because shortly after the dinosaurs, we had, when whales had legs, we had a pufffish, right? And that sort of evolved into what we call the sunfish?
Yeah, well, we had the molas come from a group of coral reef fishes that were, I like saying, built for comfort, not for speed. They're like little armored tanks. And one faction of those maneuverable tank-like fishes went off into the open ocean and left their tail behind and have a tail to tell.
A tail to tell, indeed. They also, we were talking about eggs before with Matt and these hipster toads protecting their eggs. Sunfish have more eggs, I think, than any vertebrate. What, about 300 million eggs?
That is the estimate, and that has never actually, this is where, that was an estimate done in the 20s. It's never been recounted, and actually, I'm working on that. And
it takes too long. Yeah.
It takes a long time. One, two, what would you name all those offspring? they do provide food for all sorts of other predators who know when that spawning occurs, but I think it's probably not 300 million. I think that number needs to be adjusted, but it is one of the most fecund vertebrates on the planet.
And did you also point out the fact that they can gain about 800 pounds in a matter, or excuse me, they can actually go without food for about, I'm getting statistics in my head. Mm-hmm. First of all, how long can they go without actually eating? That's what I meant to ask you.
Well, that's a difficult thing to know. I mean, certainly weeks, if not months. But in terms of their growth trajectory, that's where they really shine.
That's what I was initially. I was tripping over myself. But in how many months? 800 pounds?
Like, 800 pounds in about 14 months.
Yeah, and I remember you said that's a true American.
It's a true American. Yeah. Actually, that applies to many different parts of the world now, unfortunately. But they can pack on the pounds very quickly. And from that little hatchling size, the weight to their full adult weight, that would be like me having a child that would then be the weight of six Titanic ships.
Wow.
Or 22,000 school buses. So that's a large growth trajectory.
And this is a large fish, to put it mildly. You've been tagging them, though, in Taiwan and in Japan?
In Japan, yeah. I just got back from Galapagos, when we were tagging a bunch of them. So
what brought you to them? I mean, there's a story I think you told about you were a graduate advisor. You saw a picture of the fish on a wall, and that was it? You fell in love?
Well, and I had heard about them, being a native Californian, but then my graduate advisor, Stephen Wainwright, who's a biomechanist at Duke, had a little tiny picture of the sunfish, and I said, that looks like how I would draw a fish when I'm 3 years old. It looks like a child's drawing. And he said, well, you could study them if you wanted to. And I became captivated because they looked like such a mistake. They looked like... why did you do that?
Questioning our creator.
and as a biomechanist, I thought they've got a little story to tell. And with anything in biology, the more you find out about even the most mundane creature, the better questions come out and the more fascinating they become. The familiar becomes strange and the strange becomes familiar.
And the great thing about sunfish is you can pet them.
they actually do appreciate a little bit of TLC that way because they're heavily parasitized. And Matt, we could talk sunfish parasites for a long time. They've got some dastardly ones. But they do get by with a little help from their friends, little cleaner fish, even seabirds. They'll come to the surface. That's where they get their common name, sunfish. And they'll expose their body to seabirds who will come and pick parasites off them, give them a little spa treatment, exfoliation, and have at it.
Again, Tierney Tees is marine biologist, filmmaker, and National Geographic explorer, and studies the giant sunfish. I also have with us Brian Fisher, who's curator and chief of entomology here at the California Academy of Sciences. For over 20 years, he's traveled the world, identified and named ants, and has himself discovered 1,000 ant species of 22,000 that exist, so that we've discovered so far, many more perhaps. Actually, the first discoverer of ants was Linnaeus, I learned.
Right. He had this very simple approach, like many of you probably. He called the first ant the black ant, Formica nigra, the next ant the red ant. And he ran out of names, I guess, and stopped. But since then, we've described over 15,000 species. We're about halfway there.
That's amazing. It's also, E.O. Wilson, of course, is a champion of the world of ant study, Pismire study, I guess you would say, to be technical, or if you do crossword puzzles. But why study ants? I mean, other than the obvious reasons of how they have hierarchies and how they work and so forth, and I was thinking about this, I was reflecting on this, I want to hear your thoughts, but in some ways they're microcosms of our own humanity, aren't they?
Right, and that's one attraction, right? They're social, and that's impressive, right? If you look at one ant, that's not really looking at the ant. To understand an ant, you have to look at it as this superorganism, the whole thing. For example, this is a test. Now, why do you think ants bring food back to the nest? Now, Michael, if you were an ant and it was hot and you were thirsty and you had this juicy caterpillar in your mouth, what would you do? Would you hide behind a rock and eat half of it?
No, maybe. Obviously their followers are Bernie Sanders. They want to share with all of them. So.
They would want to share, but why? Well, you can only understand ants by realizing that they can't eat a solid food. They have to bring the food back to the nest because the stomach of the colony is in the nest. They have to feed that caterpillar to their larva, which then digest it and then squirt it back up and share it with a few sisters, the workers, and then they take into their social stomach and then devise a way to efficiently transfer that energy throughout the nest. And that's the brilliance of ants. They've had a long time, about 140 million years, to evolve very efficient ways to work as a social unit.
Well, since you talk about that long time, we go back to the fact that evolutionary tied to wasps. Yeah?
Right. To understand a wasp, to understand ants, you have to look at the wasps. And like wasps, they can be mean too. They have stingers. But not all of them. Like the ones in your bathroom in the Bay Area don't have a stinger.
Can we talk about some of these strange creatures, which has been our mission here in this hour? You've got a trap jaw ant that was discovered, I believe, in Costa Rica. They can move their jaws as fast as a cheetah, or faster than a cheetah can run, which is extraordinary.
Right. It's amazing. You can't even see it with your eyes. In fact, it all started by this little competition with a scientist at Berkeley that our ants were faster than your shrimp. And so we brought our ants back from Costa Rica and we filmed it, and we were surprised how fast it was. It was the fastest actually recorded animal movement ever.
And then you've got the Dracula ant?
Right. So the Dracula ant is the ant that doesn't have what I just described as social food transfer. It actually doesn't have a baby that can spit up food, and then a worker takes it and puts it in the social stomach and moves it around. For the Dracula ant, every ant has to go up to their sister, the baby, scratch it until it bleeds, and drink the blood of their own sisters. And then even the queen has to do that. Don't try this at home.
Google Earth has been a big aid to you, hasn't it? Tremendously.
Yeah. Right. In the beginning, for most people, insects are diverse. They're everywhere. But at the same time, they're invisible.
Although you've been mostly in Madagascar, yeah.
Right. I've worked all over, but I actually focused in Madagascar. So I wanted to prove that we can actually go from collection to discovery to actually conservation. And that's what I wanted to. Madagascar on the map looked really small. I thought it would take me 3 years, but I've worked there over 25 years now and discovered many things, but I'm still struggling with the application to conservation. But Google Earth did help. In fact, I tried to get their attention. Hey, ants, it's hard to conserve an elephant. Try conserving an ant. I mean, we have a perception problem. In fact, people only concerned about ants and when it arrives in your bathroom, but that's another story. But to get Google Earth to get excited by helping us, I described an ant after Google, Prostratum Google, a specialized ant on...
They need more branding, right?
Exactly. They need more branding. But I got their attention, got a Newsweek, and then they called and said, now, what were you saying you need help with? Anyway, we kind of used Google Earth to start mapping biodiversity, which was a new approach back then, and that was really helpful.
There are all kinds of ants that we could talk about. There are mafia ants and mass murder ants and pillage ants that are invisible and everything. Why do we need to conserve them?
Why do we need to conserve them? That's interesting. Here, I thought we were talking about the coolness of organisms today, but we can also talk about why, who cares? And that is because you can't even conceive of an ecosystem without thinking of the insects. I mean, it's the glue that holds an ecosystem together. You go into the Muir Woods, you go, wow, what a beautiful big tree. But behind that is the brown turning over nutrients, not just the green. That brown cycle is ruled by the insects, especially ants. In fact, without ants, you wouldn't have soil, you wouldn't have the turning over nutrients, you wouldn't have that glue that makes ecosystems work. And ants love to work.
Well, you're mapping all these ants, and Rebecca Johnson is with us as well, and she's been leading science research through Citizenship, teams of volunteers out there to discover, to document, to essentially monitor all kinds of invertebrates as well as seaweeds. She's Citizen Science Research Coordinator here at the California Academy of Sciences. And Rebecca, let's talk about just how important this is to biodiversity, I mean, with respect to getting citizens mobilized the way you've been doing.
Yeah, thank you, Michael. I think the stories that everyone just shared really illustrate, like, all of us became interested in science because of a cool story or a cool discovery that we made as a kid or even as an adult. And so through our work in citizen science, we work to harness that curiosity that everyone has and get people to make and share their observations and help mobilize those observations for science and for conservation.
And all you have to do now is go to an iNaturalist app, right? And you can be a citizen scientist?
Yeah, I mean, if you think of all of us, how many of us take a picture of a plant or animal in a given day and then just take that picture and upload it to iNaturalist? If you take it with your phone, it has a date and time stamp and a geolocation, so it knows where you are. And that then is, if you feed it to the community of naturalists online that make up iNaturalist, you don't have to know it's a Dracula ant that you took a picture of, but someone else online will know that and help you learn your natural history a little bit better, and also make that observation into a data point. And then in aggregate, the over 3 million observations that have been made and shared using iNaturalist can help inform conservation.
Yeah, we did a whole program on citizen science, and it's amazing to what extent it really contributes to conservation and just really letting us know important information. Also, Rebecca's work, I should say, is with sea slugs. Maybe we can find out about that as we move along here. But I want to find out what's on your minds. If you're in the audience, raise your hand. We'll come to you with any questions or comments you might have. You can also join us if you're listening at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. We do welcome your phone calls, so feel free to call us now. Again, it's toll-free, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org. Talking with Rebecca Johnson, Tierney Tees, Brian Fisher, Matt Simon, and a live studio audience, this is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We are on the road. We're at the California Academy of Science with a whole panel here this hour exploring the wild world of weird creatures. Matt Simon here is science writer and video host of Wired, and also used to write Wired's Absurd Creature of the Week column and has a new book out called The Wasp That Brainwashed the Caterpillar, Evolution's Unbelievable Solutions to Life's Biggest Problems. We also have Brian Fisher, curator and chair of entomology here at the California Academy, and Tierney Tees, who is a marine biologist, filmmaker, and National Geographic explorer, and Rebecca Johnson, citizen science research coordinator at the California Academy of Sciences and also a research associate in the Invertebrate Zoology and Geology Department. And we do welcome your involvement in the program. If you have questions or comments, please feel free to bring them from the audience, or you can call us at our toll-free number, which is 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org. I want to go back to you, Rebecca, if I could, just for a moment, to talk. Like I said, we focused in a forum program on citizen science, but let's talk about the achievements of what citizen science has brought to light.
Well, citizen science, there's been citizen science that has brought biodiversity to light since we've been studying biodiversity. You know, most of the our understanding of the natural world comes from people that were not paid to do that work originally. And now with the advent of technology, we're just able to share and aggregate that information more rapidly and more easily. So citizen scientists have helped us discover new species, have helped us understand how birds migrate across the United States or across the world, have helped us understand where logging is happening illegally in rainforests. I mean, you could go on and on with the contributions that volunteers...
Which have led to some arrests, in fact.
Yeah, in some places they have figured out when illegal logging is happening using some technology and citizen scientists and been able to stop that logging from happening.
I think we have a question for you from the audience. Ted, go ahead. Join us, please.
Rebecca, I'm always amazed to hear how some kids on the Bayside have never visited the ocean 7 miles away. Across the city. So could you explain how kids can become involved in citizen science here at this museum or across the nation in all the museums and in schools?
Sure. Thanks, Ted. Ted is actually one of the volunteers and a citizen scientist here at the Academy. And so anyone can contribute to our knowledge of the natural world, and anyone can do citizen science. It just takes... So the citizen science that I'm talking about today is about biodiversity and our natural world, but citizen science is a tool and an instrument and a protocol that can be used across all fields. I'm going to focus specifically on nature and biodiversity. But making an observation and paying attention and sharing that with a scientist or the conservation community and the world at large is something that anyone can do. And we found that, iNaturalist is this amazing platform to aggregate all of those observations, but really a really fabulous community of people in person that are there together to discover, that come to one place or come to a place that they love but haven't looked at in a certain way and really discover and explore what can be found there together is really this experience that both children and adults can share, and they can share knowledge and discovery and wonder together. And then by sharing those observations on iNaturalist, it also becomes data that can be used for conservation and science. So kids, adults, anyone around the world can use these tools. We do some events called BioBlitzes, and we have a number of events coming up in the next couple months that people can go to our website and find out about. One of the most exciting things that we're doing in April, so April 14th to 17th, we're hosting the City Nature Challenge. And this is a challenge that we did last year with the LA County Natural History Museum. We challenged them to see who could find more biodiversity in their region, the San Francisco Bay Area or LA. Last year, it was basically a tie, although LA won by just a little bit. But this year, we will win. And even more exciting, so this year, it's not just San Francisco versus LA, but it's San Francisco, LA, and 16 other cities across the country participating in the City Nature Challenge. So all you have to do to help the San Francisco Bay Area win is get out between April 14th and 17th, take a picture of any plant or animal that you see, share it with iNaturalist, and we'll win.
And since Rebecca mentioned websites, you can actually see photos of many of the creatures that we've been talking about on our website, kqed.org/forum. I want to go to a caller next, and that's Evie joining us from Santa Rosa. Evie, go ahead. You're on the air.
My son is very scared of bugs, crawling or flying, and I would like some suggestions to make him become a little, overcome this phobia.
Thanks. All right. Matt or Brian, can you help? This fear of bugs in children.
Oh, it's deplorable. No, that's mean to kids. No, kids, I mean, if people are legitimately afraid of bugs, that's fine. But I think what I try to do, and I imagine what Brian tries to do, is to shed light on these insects that are particularly strange, that are elusive, that are maybe new to science. There are some very strange creatures out there that will not bite you. Very few of them do, so don't be afraid because of that. But I try to make it known that insects are very important, as does Brian, and they are to be respected.
And ants should be respected too, right?
Well, you're right, and it's a great opportunity. You know, you don't have to go outside to see nature. They come inside, and you can you can actually leave little cookie crumbs and just watch them. You know, they have all their whole behavior repertoire. Maybe there are even some zombies there. You can watch it. It's real.
I got to ask Rebecca Johnson about, we were talking about all these strange creatures. I alluded to the fact that she worked with sea slugs, otherwise known as nudibranchs. Can you tell us about these slimy creatures, which also might put some kids off or people in general?
Oh my gosh, nudibranchs are one of those amazing creatures in the world. So they're these tiny sea slugs. So they're really just marine snails without a slug, without a shell. And they are every color, pattern, and color that you can imagine. And I became interested in working on them because of their brilliant, amazing color patterns. I wanted to figure out how those color patterns had evolved. And they're blue and pink and striped and polka dotted and really, if you can think it up, there's a nudibranch out there that looks just incredible. And not only that, nudibranchs are carnivores, and they're kind of a grazing carnivore. So we don't usually think about grazing carnivores on land, but they eat other invertebrate animals that can't move. So they eat sponges, they eat corals, they eat anemones. And they have figured out different ways to take the defenses that those corals and anemones and sponges use to avoid predation and kind of co-opt those defenses for their own. So there are some nudibranchs that eat sea anemones and corals have special stinging cells. Nudibranchs take those stinging cells and use them for their own defense by putting them through their whole gut and back onto their back, and then they have their own stinging cells made by their prey.
We got about 3,000 species of nudibranchs, and new ones are found almost every day?
Yeah, there are about 3,000 described species of nudibranchs, probably more than double that we have not yet described. And then nudibranchs are part of a bigger group that includes sea slugs that might have a reduced or a shell inside their bodies, like sea hares and some things that people might be familiar with.
Well, when I think of sea slugs, and again, I think of sliminess, but boy, we want sliminess, you go to the hagfish, Matt, right?
Oh, most certainly. Yeah, the hagfish, sorry to gross you out, I hope nobody ate breakfast. The hagfish is a very ancient lineage of creature that expels a tremendous amount of snot when it's threatened. So it spends its days with its head buried in carcasses on the seafloor, and sometimes a shark will come by and try to eat it. When that happens, when it bites around this fish, these specialized glands release a tremendous amount of goo, and not only that, but these fibers that get tangled up. So there's a cloud of fibers and gel that actually gets stuck in a shark's gills and can suffocate it to death. So this is their weird defense. And what's amazing about these glands is there are single cells in this that eject those strands. Each of those strands is 6 inches long, and it fits into a microscopic cell. It's packed so tightly. And when it unpacks, it hits the water, it expands, and it blows out this cloud really thick, and it gets all tangled up in a shark, and they can very well die. You've weaponized snot, essentially.
Yeah, well, let's give them their props, though. They're very important to the ecosystem.
Absolutely. They're the trash compactors of the deep.
Yeah. And have four hearts?
Yes, that's my understanding. Why not? That's better than one, right?
Well, some comments. Actually, Holly writes, please have Michael, that's me, ask the panel about design and engineering innovations based on weird animal functions or structures, for example, in terms of biomimicry.
Yeah, well, the ocean has all sorts of examples.
Trinities.
In that realm. Like, for instance, abalone shells. I mean, if you look at the microstructure of abalone shells under scanning electron micrographs, you see it's a composite of these calcite plates and then flexible polymers. And it's a very, very tough structure. I mean, rivaling that of titanium. Or you could look at how to, when you're living in a high-energy environment, like the intertidal getting slammed by waves every, thousands of times a day, how do you stay put in there? And so the Bissell threads of mussels have this underwater adhesive that allow them to stay in there, under these incredibly high energy habitats. So what's going on there? Could we perhaps make use of those underwater adhesive qualities, or the strength of abalone shells, or there's even you look at boxfish. They have a sort of interesting hydrodynamic shape that has inspired car makers. I look at the CRX, the Honda CRX, and I think boxfish.
I wonder how many people have that association. We're going to go into the audience again. Arthur. Heather, excuse me. Heather, join us, please.
Hi, my question's for Matt. It sounds like you've studied a lot of parasitic relationships in animals where one's taking advantage of the other. I was wondering if you've discovered any unusual examples of cooperation or mutually beneficial relationships.
So that gets extremely fascinating in parasitic worms that are able to manipulate behavior. So this happens a lot in these little crustaceans called gammarids that you'll find in freshwater systems. And you have these worms called acanthocephalins. And what they can do is really weird things with the behavior of the gammarids when they get in their bodies. They'll actually drive them up toward the surface. And that's because the worm needs to complete its life cycle in the belly of a bird, which is a fascinating manipulation in and of itself. But things get more complicated when you have more than one species of acanthocephalin in the same gammarid. So you can have two that want to get both to the surface to get eaten by a bird. They'll actually cooperate and kind of join their forces to make this behavior happen. But sometimes you'll have a worm that wants to get into a bird and a worm that wants to get into a fish. And when it wants to get into a fish, it'll actually keep the gammarid from the surface and keep it down in the depths, but also out in the light where a fish can see it. So they'll actually fight each other behaviorally for this gammarid by releasing different chemicals. And a lot of times one will win out and the other one will definitely lose, because if it ends up in the belly of a wrong host, it dies, but the other one wins. It's very new science, but it's a fascinating phenomenon.
And again, Matt Simon is science writer and video host of Wired and author of The Wasp That Brainwashed the Caterpillar. Here's Mark, who writes, great show today. Thank you, Mark. Could your guest talk about any new research about slime molds? Okay.
I can say, Michael, there's a huge and growing slime mold enthusiast community on iNaturalist. So, you know, these are very small things that don't move very fast. So taking a picture and getting identifications.
Well, thank heavens, because it's obvious we need more information.
Yeah, so I would say go to iNatural, see what we know about slime molds in your community, and go out, take some pictures and share them.
But there is a slime mold-seeking community, so to speak?
There is. I mean, there are naturalists that are interested in almost every, you know, thing you can imagine. And one of the great things that we can do is in person and online kind of cultivate and fuel and build people's sense of community by sharing those observations and learning from each other.
And Charlie's in the audience. Charlie, would join us, please.
Thank you. Wonderful program. My question is, we hear a lot about bees being threatened with extinction. Is there something similar happening with ants? And, you know, how is it different from bees, if it is?
Well, habitat change across the world is impacting a lot of insects, pollinators, which, as humans, we need for agriculture, and ants, which we need for ecosystem function. So habitat degradation is the main threat. But also the fact that as humans move around the Earth, we've moved a lot of other organisms with them. In fact, the second colonizer after humans are usually ants. And we have one in the Bay Area, for example, the Argentine ant. There's the fire ant. There's many ants, the big-headed ant, that have colonized islands soon after humans arrived there, and they've actually resulted in a lot of impact on the native fauna and flora, and even as a bother to our Bay Area. Why our Bay Area? Well, because insects go into our homes like the ant, and then we call, you know, the insecticide company that comes out and sprays around our homes, and all that goes where? Into our bay. And it does nothing to prevent those ants from going in your house, but it does impact our bay.
Was it you, Brian, who was talking at one time about a Dow Jones for the environment?
Right.
Yeah,
right.
I really like that idea. Can you flesh it out a little bit?
Well, people ask why even look at and monitor, that's a great question. Are we impacting the insects? Well, we don't know. We haven't actually developed any way holistically to look at diversity. We don't have like a Dow Jones index of the environment that we can monitor and decide where we're going to put a school, a road, what's our impact, is it changing? People ask, why discover a new species? Well, the same reason. It's actually putting together that Dow Jones Index.
Again, we invite you and our audience to join us with any questions you might have, and listeners to call us at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or email us forum@kqed.org. Let's get Greg on the line here. Greg, join us.
Morning. I just want to I've heard that 50% of the natural wild population of animals is going to be gone in the next, like, 25 years. Is there anything that we can do about that?
Let me go to Rebecca Johnson.
Oh, my gosh, that's a huge question. I mean, Brian kind of laid out some of the biggest threats to biodiversity and wildlife on our planet, and that's habitat destruction and the spread of invasive species. So we can all work in big ways to stop that from happening, and we can work locally in our communities to promote wildlife habitat corridors to connect big tracts of land. So these big, I'm imagining that this statistic has to do with bigger wildlife, like big mammals, to connect populations to each other so they have the room that they need to survive. There are lots of citizen science projects around setting up camera traps and analyzing these are wildlife picture-taking devices, and then analyzing those data to see where big mammals are moving and using that information to better plan open spaces. But really, we need to know where plants and animals are all the time. And as scientists here, we can't do that alone. And so we need everyone's eyes on the ground to help gather data and pay attention to the places that you know and love and use that information locally to help make changes that you want to see. And then we can all work together to make bigger changes globally with that same information.
And Tierney, maybe we could get you to talk a bit about citizen science in the ocean and really more in the water than on land.
Well, yeah. I mean, when we look at our planet, it's 99% of our living space is in the ocean. You flip that around, we only live on 1%. And we are having a massive impact on the wildlife, the marine wildlife. So I think it really boils down to knowing our food web and getting more in touch with our consumer habits and how those are playing out in the natural world. You know, not all fish are created equal. Before you buy and put that fish inside your body, you should know, has it been sustainably fished? What role did it play in its ecosystem? And is there perhaps an alternative that you can choose to eat? The same thing goes for the coffee that you buy, the clothes that you wear. Everything that we purchase and we make a statement when we buy it has an impact on the natural world. And so coming to understand where all these products that we purchase so without a lot of consciousness sometimes, I think that'll go a long way. And teaching our kids to be conscious about knowing what they're buying and what they're eating and where it comes from.
Tierney Teese again is a marine biologist and studies the giant sunfish. And we'll go to another call here. Jessica, join us. You're on the air.
Hi. I recently experienced a large ant die-off in my artist studio. They were black ants, and there were literally thousands of them all over the floor in about a 30 by 10-foot space. And I was confused because I know they usually follow pheromones, and they were not in a straight line. It was very random, some huge clump all over. Anyway, curious about it. I'll take my call answer off the air. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for the call. Let me go to Brian. Brian Fisher.
Well, I'm glad you had this visit from our community, the ants. You must be doing something right in your studio. But why do they die? That's an interesting question. It could have gotten too cold, maybe, or you had a chemical out there. They're very sensitive to chemicals. In fact, ants communicate with words, in a sense, but they use chemicals, and that chemical means they also can hear chemicals, and they're very sensitive to chemicals. So you could have played with either their chemical balance or actually had a chemical that killed them. But maybe clean the house and they'll come back, I'm sure.
Or just have a picnic. Here's Shalimar who writes, okay, all this talk about ants. It reminds me of the army of ants that invaded my house in Africa when I was in the Peace Corps. We had to leave the house while they cleaned it up. They were on the walls and floor. They cleaned out all the other bugs, especially the roaches. Now, that's a bug de-infestation, but I think the implication here is the ants remained.
Well, they won't stay that long, I'm sure, but it's great when army ants visit. Now, army ants are these incredible things. They're like a leaderless wolverine pack that sweeps through the forest, eats everything, and including if they visit your house, they'll eat everything, clean you out of all those parasites that Matt loves, and then they'll leave in a day or two. But they are a bit of a pest when they're there. So most of the local people will just leave and move out of their house for 2 days, then come back to a very clean home.
Talk about some of the varieties of ants, if you would, a little bit more. Aren't there ants that actually get other ants to do slave labor for them?
Right, even in Marin County. Yes, there's a local ant called Polyergus. It's actually it's closely related to another ant that actually it enslaves, or we use the word now, pirate, I think. They take the babies, which are in a cocoon or in a larva, who don't know there's been a switch, and actually take them into their nest. They grow up thinking, I'm home. Hello, Mom. But actually, that's the new owner, and they start working for them instead. And it actually solves a critical problem for ants. You see, ants are social, but there's a queen that starts off often alone. How did she start alone? Well, one way is to actually go into another nest, kill off the queen, and take all the workers there to work for her.
Can you talk about the crazy ants?
The crazy ants, or the crazy ant scientists. Which ones do you prefer? Now, the crazy ants, that's another introduced ant that's actually sweeping through Texas and so forth. They've invented all these great names for them, like the crazy ant. Crazy because when it's disturbed, it just runs around like it doesn't know what to do. But actually, it's one of these introduced ants that's getting into electrical wires. We don't know why. Maybe it's an electromagnetic field. But it's actually quite a growing pest problem. It's another kind of boom right now that's happening. It'll probably bust soon and die down. But right now, it's a lot in the news in Texas.
And again, Brian Fisher is curator and chair of entomology here at the California Academy of Sciences. Mari writes to us, the New York Times had an article just last week about the fact that there are only 30 vaquitas left. They're a tiny dolphin and will soon be extinct as a result of grill net fishing in Mexico. How can we put pressure on Mexico to eradicate gillnets? Some thoughts, Tierney Tees?
Yeah, well, so the vaquita, it's the world's smallest dolphin, and they are the most endangered cetacean. And they live up in the northern part of the Sea of Cortez, the Gulf of California. And in addition to that whole area being changed because of the Colorado River not emptying into that body of water, that's another effect. But this issue of gillnets, well, you have to, that takes policy changing. Mexico has outlawed drift gillnets off the California, down Baja, California. But then when you outlaw one form of fishing, then the pressure shifts to another form of fishing, in that case maybe long lining. And you have different knock-on effects and bycatch. So it's really looking at the whole system and trying to provide an alternative economy so that they can use that. But I think writing letters and increasing awareness is part of it.
Well, when you talk about putting pressure on Mexico, there's a new president of the United States who's been trying to do that in terms of the cost of building a wall. That may be a little more formidable than getting some action with respect to grill nets. Let me get another caller on here. And Ando, that's you from Palo Alto. You're on the air.
Hi. My question is about trying to minimize our impact on biodiversity in the future by actually trying to simulate human effects on a large scale and how the natural world works and how these two interact. And are you looking at these large-scale simulations as a way into understanding this?
Who'd like to come up to the fore here? Rebecca, you look like you're about to say.
What was the question?
Stimulate biodiversity more. Matt, go ahead.
I think an interesting thing that's coming up now is the idea of a gene drive. So what scientists are exploring is for conservation to be able to engineer creatures that help keep those populations in the wild in check. This is big with mosquitoes, for instance. So you might be able to engineer a mosquito male that when he reproduces with a female, the offspring die spontaneously. So this idea can be spread possibly to the idea of removing mammals from tropical islands where they're not belonging because they were brought there by human beings. So if you can get rid of those mammals, or rats and cats and things like that, with gene drives, then you can have these other populations that are native bounce back. But again, this is controversial because
there are unintended consequences.
Yeah, this is hugely controversial in conservation right now because you just cannot be sure if this is what's going to happen here because it's so new. But it is a promising way, done in a very sober way, that scientists will, of course, do. Nobody's going to go out releasing things willy-nilly for the fun of it, to be able to get rid of invasive species to have native species bounce back.
To realize how intricate the whole ecosystem is, how intimately involved and synchronicity on every level.
It's extraordinarily complicated. Modeling it with math is getting possible, but there are so many interconnections that it's just astonishing. You mess up one thing, and the cascading effects can be devastating.
Yeah. Well, any other species that we should know about as we come to the end of this hour? Strange things that are crawling around or flying around or swimming around us? Any of you want to?
I have a local one, actually.
Good. Let's hear it.
The toadfish. was a problem up in Marin not too long ago, a couple decades ago. There was this strange noise in Sausalito with these people in their houseboats were hearing in the middle of the night. They thought that it was the government, UFOs, things like that. Turns out it wasn't the government or UFOs. It's this little fish, and the males produce this extremely loud hum. It sounds like a squadron of World War II bombers. I don't know what that sounds like. I've never heard a World War II bomber, but that's what
some
I hear.
Some old veterans gave word to that. Yeah,
yeah. So they're singing like this to attract mates, and whoever's from Marin here, probably a good amount of you might remember that there was a parade in their honor after a while that once they figured this out, John McCosker here at the Academy of Sciences was actually the one who cracked the mystery, and I think it was Tom Brokaw, one of the national news guys, was incredulous that this could be a fish and not something more scandalous.
Well, I thank you all. We have come to the end of the hour, ending on that local note. And I thank Matt Simon, again, who's science writer and video host for Wired. And let's plug his book again. It's called The Wasp That Brainwashed the Caterpillar, Evolution's Unbelievable Solutions to Life's Biggest Problems. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
And thanks to Brian Fisher, curator and chief of entomology, the California Academy of Sciences, who for over 20 years now has been traveling the world, identifying, naming ants, and has himself discovered 1,000 of those species. Thank you for joining us.
May the ants be with you.
And thank you, and the uncles. Thank you, Tierney Tees, a bad old joke. Marine biologist, filmmaker, National Geographic explorer, studies a giant sunfish, which can grow more than 10 feet long and weigh over 5,000 pounds. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Michael.
And thank you, Rebecca Johnson, citizen science research coordinator here at the California Academy of Sciences, who studies the nudibranch, or the sea slug.
Thank you very much.
And thank you, our listeners. More Forum is produced by Irene Gucci, Judy Campbell, Tina Larberg, Susan Britton, and Jeremy Siegel. Engineers are Danny Bringer, Jim Bennett, and Howard Gilman. Engagement producer Amanda Stupai. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.